What's up, Dune fans? Welcome back to the Dune Not Enter podcast, where today neither water nor spice can stop a man who wants to jam.
What the man wants to jam to? I guess we'll have to find out.
Indeed. I'm your host, Humphrey Shu, and joining me are my friends and co-hosts, Fillmore John.
What's up, guys?
And Nolan Zhang.
Hi guys, welcome back.
Hey guys, welcome back. I again forgot what episode number this is, but we will be going over chapter
38.
But we will be going over chapter 33 of the book Dune. I'm really excited to be here with both of you guys, and also really happy that you listeners are tuning in. So yeah, this is a really exciting chapter, although it's a bit of an anticlimax because we, you know, Nolan so ingeniously picked a cliffhanger to end us off on, but hopefully that just keeps...
I finally tip y'all off of the cliffhanger.
Yeah, it just keeps y'all coming back for more, hopefully. Right, so anything new that's been happening this week for y'all? Anything fancy that you'd like to inform us about?
I was trying out a new RC helicopter that has been in storage in my house for years, and I kind of like broke it in the first 10 minutes, so this is not going too well.
Oh no, that's not good.
Yeah.
Ooh, is it broken, or can you fix it?
I need replacement parts.
Oh.
Well, that's unfortunate. I kind of saw this coming.
Yeah, Oh, that's unfortunate. Well, yeah, all the best to you, and you're replacing.
Indeed. I don't know how I want to do it.
Yeah.
Well, as for me, our school held a car wash, and I was there volunteering, setting stuff up. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I was part of the committee, like setting everything up, which was pretty cool.
Epic.
Did you get wet?
Yeah, I did. Someone sprayed me.
Yeah, I feel like these fundraiser car washers, just everyone spraying each other. You know?
Yeah.
Okay, yep. Wait, there was a moment when someone threw a water balloon at me and it bounced off my arm and hit someone else.
Wow. That's really quite lucky, honestly. Y'all bring water balloons?
I was standing
balloons?
Still for them to hit me and they still failed.
Y'all bring water balloons?
Oh, someone brought balloons and then we filled them up.
Oh my. Yeah, seems like it was quite the rave. Cool. Alrighty. Well, that's really fun. Let's dive into this chapter's discussion. So again, we'll be going over the first half of chapter 33. This ends on this quote, and in the middle of the last word, he pounced. Yeah, this guy is jamming indeed. Well, Nolan, I'll let you take it away with the epigraph.
All right. So the epigraph goes, "My father, the Padishah Emperor, was 72, yet looked no more than 35. The year he encompassed the death of Duke Leto and gave Arrakis back to the Harkonnens. He seldom appeared in public wearing other than a Sardaukar uniform and a Berserk's black helmet with an imperial lion and goat upon his crest. The uniform was an open reminder of where his power lay. He was not always that blatant, though. When he wanted, he could radiate charm and sincerity. But I often wonder in these later days if anything about him was as it seemed. I think now he was a man fighting constantly to escape the bars of an invisible cage. You must remember that he was an emperor, father head of a dynasty that reached back into the dimmest history, but we denied him a legal son. Was this not the most terrible defeat a ruler ever suffered? My mother obeyed her sister's superiors, where the Lady Jessica disobeyed. Which of them was the stronger? History already has answered. In my father's house by the Princess Irulan."
Ooh.
I know,
it's a little bit depressing of an epigraph, I think.
We get to hear more about Irulan and what her thoughts are about the current situation, so
yep,
I don't mind.
Yep.
Yeah, so we actually have Princess Irulan speaking again about her father, the Emperor. I remember we had this several epigraphs ago. We heard about their family dynamic and just how broken it really was.
Mm-hmm.
How like the Emperor was especially barred from producing an heir because of the Bene Gesserit plan, which are enforced by his Bene Gesserit wife and daughter. And here we see Princess Irulan speaking about her father being strong, charismatic, and sincere, but at the same time doubtful of these because she believes they're superficial. And in this regard, she kind of refers to Lady Jessica and her disobedience of the Bene Gesserit through the bearing of Paul to like give a counter argument on like, what if Irulan and her mom just like let her father have a son, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then like she points to the fact that of like the troubled fate of Jessica, and that just like justifies Irulan and her mom to be like, oh, it is okay, or like I should be following the Bene Gesserit plan, or else terrible stuff will happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like it just keeps them like in check, I guess, even if they have reservations or like their feelings change about their plan for the emperor.
Right. Yeah, it almost makes you pity the emperor. I mean, he's in such a position of high power. He's just unable to fight this inexorable Bene Gesserit influence that, you know, they, you know, exert over him. And somehow I have a feeling this will contribute to his downfall, because his inability to control matters fully within his own house is such a handicap. I feel he can't even find satisfaction and safety within his own circle, right? And it's also interesting that there's such a heavy implication at the end that Jessica ultimately succeeds and becomes this prominent historical figure, where it says, yeah, which one of them was the stronger, history already has answered, right? And I mean, I suppose, I guess, that we don't have to worry about Jessica being killed off anytime soon, which is is really, you know, good for us readers. Yeah, so we don't have to stress about that. But
yeah, the situation sort of reminds me of the saying, most powerful man in the universe, second only to his wife.
That's honestly so true.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, that's, yeah. I mean, happy wife, happy life. Yeah.
But I mean, if you were to get, or if his wife were to produce a son, do you think there's any chance of him becoming the Quetzal's Hadera?
I feel that it's been heavily implied that the Quetzal's Hadera is just a singular entity throughout history. And okay, it's also mentioned that so many people failed, you know, and just from a plot analysis perspective, I feel that Paul, you know, they have to, unless this kind of degrades into two Quetzal's Haderachs going at each other for world domination, which is not, you know, I don't think that's what Herbert is intending here.
Yeah.
I think Herbert's trying to maintain Paul's specialness, right? And the way to do that is, of course, not to make, you know, another Quetzal's Haderach. Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah. So thank you for that analysis, Nolan. Before we jump into the rest of the chapter, we'll have our quote section. So Fillmore, you have the first quote.
Okay, my quote this week is, wealth, she thought. She shook her head, feeling the coldness in his voice. Where I was born, water fell from the sky and ran over the land in wide rivers, she said. There were oceans of it so broad you could not see the other shore.
Just bragging.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, definitely the Fremen cannot understand, but... Yep. All right, my quote goes, prescience had fed his knowledge with countless experiences, hinted at the strongest currents of the future and the strings of decision that guided them. But this was the real now. This was death hanging on an infinite number of minuscule mischances. Okay, yeah, the writing here, I really enjoyed that, but the meaning is quite profound also.
Mm-hmm. So for my quote, I chose, the good knife fighter thinks on point and blade and shearing guard simultaneously. The point can also cut, the blade can also stab, the shearing guard can also trap your opponent's blade.
Ooh, if any of y'all ever get in a single combat and both of y'all only have swords, you know what to do.
But don't bring a sword to a gunfight.
Indeed, yeah. Don't bring a knife to a gunfight. Yeah, let's go.
Unless you're a Jedi.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, is that even a sword anymore?
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Alrighty. Okay. Well, yeah, let's dive into the bulk of the chapter.
Mm-hmm. So we start off with the Fremen and Jessica and Paul inside these caves, and we get a little glimpse of what the Fremen do in order to make an atmosphere, I guess in the atmosphere where they're like comfortable taking off their steel suits and like effective, right? So we see them, they seal off any openings with what they describe as a plastic hood, which traps moisture from leaving the cave into the dry outside air. So thinking about it, I guess I imagine it like kind of a tarp type of thing, where it's like a blue tarp they put over the entrance. And then the Fremen just, like, actively cutting off ventilation from the cave. And it's just like, wow, I can't even imagine how, like, stale and humid the air must be inside these caves. Because,
yeah, it must suck having to breathe in the moisty air that's probably filled with skin flakes and the like. But I guess I would prefer this instead of drying up into a mummy.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose they do need a way, and they probably have a way of reclaiming the moisture within this cave. But, I mean... no ventilation system is, I mean, it's going to get real stuffy in here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people, lots of that carbon dioxide getting generated, you know, cave better be pretty big.
I guess the only way to fix this is just to keep going outside.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I just wanted to note a funny thing. When Jessica wakes up, she realized that she permitted herself to sleep soundly, but she hasn't seen, I suppose, the negativity of Jamis and his weird acting and whatever recently, right? So yeah, so that's just something she missed, which is really weird that she's missing things like this. But I mean, I suppose she has her mind on other things.
Yeah, I think she's just been too preoccupied with carrying her family, right? Because like right now she's just like wondering how to keep them safe, and she forgot to, like, she did see Jamis kind of upset before, but I guess she didn't extrapolate it enough to like predict this as an outcome, because she's too caught up in focusing on like her position in the tribe and trying to figure out what the Reverend Muller and everything that the Fremen were referring to in the religion area. So I guess she was just preoccupied. So also from Jessica's description, we also understand that the spice does appear to, whenever Paul uses it, or like whenever Paul enters like the prescient state or whatever, it does kind of a physical effect on Paul, because she describes Paul as not yet fully aware of his return, his eyes half shut and glassy with the inward stare. I guess just like Paul looks like he's dead in the morning, like me, you know.
Yeah, always. I feel like I look like Paul. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess it just also means that the spice vision Paul receives does take their toll. So like he can't, I assume that he can't just use it forever, you know.
Or maybe he might eventually get used to it enough to do so, but we don't know that yet.
Yeah, maybe he develops some level of tolerance to let him use the capabilities without totally destroying his physique, right? I mean,
And so, like, the toll that we're talking about, like, I would assume that, like, the toll is similar to what caffeine does to your body. And, like, it wakes up your mind and puts it into overdrive. And... Or maybe like the effects are similar to a sugar rush where you feel super tired after the initial burst of energy.
Yeah, I mean, right, we know that melange has physical side effects, right? Because considering it lengthens your life and improves your health, it definitely would have some effects on your body, right? But I wouldn't be surprised if Paul's brain is wired in some way so that, you know, somehow the spice maybe binds the neural receptors or something and hyperstimulates his brain somehow. So yeah, caffeine essentially, but in a different way, you know. Yeah, so of course it will have different effects. Yeah, really interesting.
So now, like, because of Paul and just everything that's been happening and like Jessica's weirding ways, there's been like this weird legend surrounding Jessica. So in most legends, for a people to be ruled by someone, either they prove their value through their own abilities, right? And then they're usually the elite unit raised up by them among the people they govern because they trust in them. But then, like, in Jessica's case, it's kind of different, because the legend that she's presented with is that, like, she is like a prophet or something, so like she's respected, of course. But at the same time, she has a companion who's supposed to be her main guardian, but at the same time the guardian isn't a Fremen, so it's just like really confusing, because like I don't know any other like myths or stories where a hero or heroine with a champion is able to rule over a group of people when it's not their own group of people that's protecting them.
Right. Well, like this type of trope isn't really too common in modern literature, but because now that I think about it, I haven't read many books where the main character becomes the ruler of the people, because a lot of the books are about freedom, and being a king limits the main character's freedom to, let's say, continue exploring or fighting off the bad guys. So they usually relinquish the throne to like another person.
I agree. Right. Yeah, that's a good take. Yeah.
Well, like the closest thing I can really think of is Odysseus, but he was already a king before he left his people.
Yeah, so it's more like reclaiming his kingship, right? I mean, that's true. It's hard, especially in modern society, of course, where freedom is so emphasized, to imagine any rising to kingship stories, which is naturally confining in and of itself. And I suppose that we'd have to look far back into, say, I don't know, Arthurian legend to find anything of that sort somehow. Definitely cannot recall anything where a king rises to power someone rises to power through the championing of another, right? So
yeah, like protected by someone else, not themselves. Yeah, you
know? Yeah, because generally you want to prove your own worth,
right?
Which is really weird. Yeah, but so. Again, you know, later Jessica mentions, I'll mention it again later too when we get to that point, is that Jessica says that somehow the Missionaria Protectiva's ways have been twisted on Arrakis, right? So, you know, this is maybe just one of those inconsistencies after such a long period of time.
Yeah.
Yep.
But here we also get something pleasantly, at least I was pleasantly surprised at one thing Jamis was saying when she challenged Jessica here. He was basically, after he challenged Jessica to like let Paul fight for her, he was just like, and Jessica obviously objected because she loves her son. Jamis basically told her to stop talking because he's right to basically suspect that the more Jessica talks, the more dangerous she is. Though like he's not in his best state right now, he's kind of paranoid and just throwing out false scenarios. But at the same time, the one thing that he did get right was that Jessica could be very manipulative, so he's right to be cautious here.
He's really pissed right now because he got destroyed by Paul in an instant.
Yeah.
Even though he's supposed to be one of the strongest among them.
Yeah, supposed keyword.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess his pride was hurt so much that he's being super hostile. I guess talk about a bad sport.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it seemed like pretty clear from the start that there was going to be some form of conflict between, you know, Jamis and Paul, given Herbert wrote twice that, you know, Jamis seemed uneasy or Jamis is standing away from the pack scowling or things like that, right? And we're finally about to see some more combat after all of those. I mean, we've seen combat. I mean, we've seen action, but this is more direct physical contact and combat.
It's a one-on-one.
Yeah. Usually duels end up being more intense.
I think so. Yeah, because it's so, you know, it's so focused, I feel like. It's laser focused.
Because if you're talking about a war, it's so chaotic, it's really difficult to tell what's going on. But duels are focused in and you can tell everything that's going
on. Yeah, exactly. Every shift of your arm, every twitch, you know, every jump, you can get into the heads of,
just like
you
how
know.
Personalized.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is something I really enjoy to see. So we saw a duel between Paul and Gurney, right?
Yeah, that scene was so epic.
Yeah, that was really epic. But that was more, I mean, it didn't seem friendly, but it's friendly. So have we seen any true, you know, Paul versus enemy or anyone versus the enemy kind of 1v1 duels? Can you think of?
I guess the closest thing to that would be when they were on the helicopter and he one kick that dude.
Oh yeah.
But it's not really a duel because he caught him off guard.
And also same thing with Jessica and Stilgar too. That was Jessica caught Stilgar off. Yeah. So
but this is like the first time where it's just like
it's a literal formal, one versus one kind of thing. So yeah, really excited. But you know, that is that'll be next week. So tune in later. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want to miss out.
Yep.
Yes, tune in for the actual fight.
Mm-hmm.
Apologies for cutting it off early.
Yeah, that's Nolan's problem. If y'all want to be mad, be mad, Nolan. Here's Nolan's email address.
Cutting it off.
Yeah,
Nolan out here edging the viewers.
Okay, so don't blame me only, guys. Stilgar was also trying to cut off the action, so it's not just my fault. So we see Stilgar kind of stepping in, trying to show some of his diplomatic skills. He's trying to de-escalate the situation, like we've all been taught. You know, don't escalate the fight. But at the same time, we obviously see that de-escalation is kind of hopeless because Jam is just kind of super mad, guys.
Yeah, he's triggered.
When that happens, there's nothing he could do. But the best he could do is try to divert some of Jamis's anger away from Paul and hopefully onto himself. And I think this like type of roundabout type of thinking just shows Stilgar's capability, not just the strongest person in the tribe as the Fremen leader, but also show that he's quite smart in the fact that he's wise and that he could like attempt to do stuff like not just through like strength but also through like thinking, you know. He's got more
through communication.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, we already knew that he was quite intelligent with his interactions with Jessica, but we can really see him in action this chapter, and I'm really glad they didn't portray him as some sort of muscle head.
It's too often that, you know, two brothers, and we know Stilgar and Kynes essentially function as brothers. It's too often that two brothers, one has the intelligence and one has the muscles, right? And we know Kynes had the intelligence, so we would naturally characterize Stilgar as having the muscles, but it seems that Stilgar also has a healthy combination of both, and that's, you know, really good. And I was going to say Stilgar also definitely would succeed in gaining Jessica's respect here, and he also gains more of our respect because he's thinking on his feet and he's trying multiple ways to help Paul and Jessica get out of this situation, right? Even though they just got to know each other and Jessica just destroyed Stilgar just a day ago, and and Stilgar doesn't hold a grudge, you know, they're already working as a unit, and that's I think just speaks volumes about Stilgar's character.
Right. Being able to move on in this type of situations fast. Is huge.
And he acts as a leader, right?
Yeah.
He takes the high road here instead of, you know, instead of just giving into his temptation of, you know, taking these people down, right? But I mean, Jessica also makes a wise choice not to just off Jamis, right? Because it's interesting that she notes that the Missionaria's work may not be what she expects. And this is what I was alluding to earlier, that the Missionaria's role and their purpose and, you know, their teachings have been so twisted on this planet that she may not be able to recognize them. And it's good to keep Jessica guessing so that she doesn't become lax and trust too much in these prophecies, right? But it just introduces another one of these things where prophecies aren't always correct. And, you know, foresight is, you know, always, should always be met with suspicion, I feel.
Especially always hold a grain of salt.
Yeah, especially in this doomed world. Yeah.
I just kind of like the cautiousness that Jessica's approaching this entire situation from, because she knows like the prophecy kind of, but at the same time it's different to the point where she doesn't want to mess it up and give up their biggest chance at survival, like prosperity within the Fremen world.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Yeah.
Okay, so here we see here that Paul and Jessica were kind of caught by Jamis and his squad carrying two leader johns?
I think you're right.
Yeah, sure.
Leader johns of water, and according to a quick internet search, it seems that a leader john is just simply one liter, but like in a container meant to carry one liter of water. And literally Paul and Jessica kind of forgetting that they were carrying half a gallon in their bag already, and now they're just like in deep water for not having shared any of this with any of the Fremen. So
The pun you used there.
I like that too.
Oh, I didn't realize, but...
Well, hopefully they can stay high and dry during the storm that's coming up ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, okay. They do get themselves out of this sticky situation quite nicely, but... And, I mean, Jessica does do a good job explaining why she didn't think much of these two leader johns and why she didn't mention them, right? I mean, she does have a good reason that she's never had to consider water in this way, and it's too easy to overlook that. Yeah, it's just, you know, 2 liters of water, you know, no big deal. Yeah, but
they're rationing anyway, so they kind of try saving every single bit to the end.
Yeah, that's a massive wealth right there. That's a few thousand dollars maybe. Yeah,
probably more.
Yeah,
Arrakis.
Yeah, Arrakis, where, you know, spice and water are exchanged. You know, water's worth as much as spice is outside of the planet,
if not more.
Yeah, if not more.
It's worth actual humans. Like, it's actually worth Fremen at that
human
point.
Life. Yeah.
Yeah, that's insane.
Okay, so now we get to my quote, which sort of expands on what we were just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Wealth, she thought. She shook her head, feeling the coldness in his voice. Where I was born, water fell from the sky and ran over the land in wide rivers, she said. There were oceans of it so broad you could not see the other shore.
Ooh, yeah.
It's such a stunning quote, to be honest. Yeah. The deep contrast of the imagery of this imagery to the dryness of Arrakis was just so sad to me. Like, even like the Fremen let out a sighing gasp when they heard about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, the situation, like, I think it's similar to talking about heaps of food in front of starving children. Mm-hmm. It's so cruel in a way.
Yeah, it's kind of insensitive on Jessica to be like, oh, my bad, I didn't realize this. Like, by the way, I was like, there's so much water on my planet that I can't imagine while they're just like here starving or like thirsting to death, you know?
Yeah, it's a little inconsiderate, but then again, they did have other things to think about.
Right.
I don't know. It reminds me of that vision Paul had again back in the first few chapters where he was talking to Chani about water and talking to her about like the oceans and all of that, and reading telling her a poem, right? It's just, you know, again, these Fremen just have no way to comprehend the vast quantity of water outside this planet.
It's like trying to explain calculus to an ape.
Yeah, honestly. Yeah, yeah. It's basically me. Yeah. But, I mean, it's just, you know, again, just shows this gap between their way of life and
the Fremen way of life.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. So here, because of this gap, Jamis was even more mad because he was like, there's no way you could buy me off with water like that.
Yeah, he's just, no bribery, no bribery.
Yeah, he's like, no, this ain't gonna work. Mm-hmm. So he tried invoking the Amto rule, and he kept talking about it. So I finally searched it up. I was like, what is the Amto rule? And I found out, according to Dune Wiki, that it's a tradition practiced on the most primitive planets. So, ouch, okay. And literally translates to tested to destruction. So basically a person is tested to discover their limits, no matter the consequences. In this case, it seems that this test would be like a test of strength, and it'll be like to the endurance, death, you know, to see how far it could go till they die.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it looks like it's going to be a bloody battle where both parties are pushed to their utmost limits.
Yeah.
But to be honest, I'm not too worried about Paul, but the consequences of the battle somewhat upset me, because they're already low on people, and killing a skilled warrior is sort of counterintuitive to their goal.
Yeah. But
like, I guess on the upside, Paul will be able to finally prove himself.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird, because in what cultures in this planet are there fights to the death, right? Because I know we had duels in America, and famously Hamilton died in a duel, and there's a lot of other duels, you know, and yeah, but I'm thinking, you know, like challenges for power or some sort, or, you know, direct challenges like this. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it must have been medieval. And why I think that is the monarchy kind of gets older and older as lifespan increases. And when you're old, you can't really fight. So it must be, you know, when the lifespan of a king is, you know, of like, was their physical prime. So their 30s and 40s was about as long as they lived. Right. And then they would be able to fight for their position.
Yeah, it's just to ensure that like you have a strong young leader leading you the entire time, instead of someone who's too incapable.
Yeah, right? And I'm not saying, you know, old leaders are necessarily bad, but I feel that, you know, like the way for them to defend their position is if they're young and they're able to battle. Yeah,
it'd be easier.
Yeah, much easier.
They're also like their brain processes probably run better as well.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So but here's the thing, there's something that I don't get from this chapter, because Jessica goes and describes like Stilgar at the same time is still upset at Jessica and them. She describes it as he had like a demoniacal stiffness.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's close enough.
Yeah. So like it took over Stilgar's expression, and Jessica thinks like he broods. He's the silent kind, one who works himself up inside. So my question is, like, what exactly is Stilgar brooding about? Do any of y'all know?
I mean, I think you may have misread, because Jessica shifts her attention to Jamis, who's brooding. So I think Stilgar has this demoniacal stiffness, and Jamis is the one that's scheming. He's the brooder, I think.
Maybe.
Well, if it is Stilgar that's brooding, I think the reason why he's doing so is probably because no matter what the outcome, it's a significant loss, and he's trying to calculate what each loss means to the Fremen.
I just think that Stilgar views this as an unnecessary waste, right? Mm-hmm. And as a leader, he has to kind of evaluate all the things that he has. Because they're Fremen, they have to have this cost benefit analysis continually running. And I think that Jamis, he's scheming for the simple reason of he's about to fight, right? And he's just angry,
and that's just not good enough for the rest of the Fremen.
He's checking out Paul, seeing how he moves, and you know, seeing what he can do, essentially trying to prepare himself.
So
this is what Paul meant when he said that he saw in his vision that he'd be dead under a knife, right? So he was actually referring to this battle. So I mean, I thought it'd be some dramatic battle far in the future. Maybe he's 1v1ing the Baron Harkonnen or something. I don't know. But just something dramatic, right? But he was really referring to just this soon to happen event. And you know,
hey, you know, we gotta work up from somewhere, you know.
Yep,
so you could 1v1 Jamis first.
Yeah, first 1v1 Jamis, and then 1v1, you know, the Baron's son, and then work up from there, right?
No, imagine Paul 1v1ing the Baron. The Baron uses his finishing move, which is just sitting on him.
Oh no, that's a whole 500 pounds of mass.
Yeah,
nothing can defend against that. just run at him like a truck. Yeah,
500 times 9.81.
Oh no, that's 5,000 newtons.
Yeah, 5,000.
Well, that's kilograms, but Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised that he was if he was 500.
Maybe like
kilograms.
Half of that amount, 2,500.
Yeah. That's still massive. Oh yeah. My. Yeah, but I mean, it's also cool how Herbert neatly, you know, switched the point of view here to Paul, and then suddenly Paul is the point of view that we see. So I mean, it was so smooth. I didn't even realize, but. Yeah,
he's so good at that.
Yeah, he is. Honestly, if I tried to write something like that, it would be super jagged and rough, and you know, it'd just be suddenly, yeah,
bro.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, none of us are writing majors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if only you know, if only English major. Yeah.
And we're all STEM majors.
True. Yeah, STEM majors is trying our best to develop our literary skills too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's a good way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am enjoying this very much. Right, but personally, I don't think Jessica's making a good decision here when she's invoking the voice, right? And I don't know why she's trying to do it, because she's trying to get this throng of Fremen to trust her, not believe her a witch, like all the other people, you know, believe the Bene Gesserit are witches. I just feel like this is such a terrible decision to suddenly try to control Jamis and put fear into his heart. And I mean, if Jamis can hear it, then I suppose everyone else can hear, you know, the fluctuations in her voice, right? And yeah, it's just
I read that part and I was like, yeah, this is a bad idea. But at the same time, Jessica does know it's a bad idea because she was warned by Stilgar and everyone else. But she still goes for it anyways, just because she was just like, I don't want Paul to lose. Like, if he loses, he dies. So I think Jessica just threw it out there just to see what's going to happen. Like, if she could, she did it anyways, even though she knows a bad hand.
Well, I think it's not only bad for the Fremen, it's also bad for Paul, because Paul needs to sort of learn through this experience. Because if it's not a fair matchup, then he's not going to learn as much. He's going to be like, I only won because of my mother instead of my own power.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I think Jessica. Syndrome. Yeah, and again, you know, we haven't gotten to this yet, and we'll discuss this later, but, you know, somehow Jessica is a little too overprotective. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily good for his character development, even though it's good for his head. Yeah, it doesn't get it off, right? But yeah, so I mean, just another interesting note here that I wanted to mention that really could have large implications, even though I can't see clearly what the implications are. Jessica says here, you'll have agony such as will make the Gom Jabbar a happy memory by comparison. So yeah, so does that mean that Jamis has a memory of the Gom Jabbar? Because that would mean these Fremen are tested with the Gom Jabbar, right? Which is crazy, because I thought it was a Bene Gesserit exclusive sort of thing, testing animals versus humans. But here it seems that the Fremen are also being tested for the humanic nature. And I mean, I guess that's why, kind of continuing off this point, it's why Jessica proclaimed that my son's been tested with the Gom Jabbar, right? Because it holds such weight for the Fremen too. And the Fremen can understand what it means to have been tested with the Gom Jabbar.
Yeah.
Well, maybe, okay, so in the alternative that, like, they actually don't individually get tested by Gom Jabbar, so you know how they have the Reverend Mother within their own system of, like, religion? Maybe they have, like, a version of the Gom Jabbar test where their Reverend Mothers go through it and then, like, the others watch. So maybe they do know how painful it is just from watching, so.
Perhaps.
They could also be faking it, right?
Yeah.
I feel like it should be someone like Stilgar that goes through the Gom Jabbar in order to confirm what it is.
Maybe.
Stilgar's arm melts off.
Oh, no. Oh. Well, he only thinks so. Yeah, he pulls it out, and instead of seeing a blackened stump, he sees his, you know, untouched
arm hole. Yeah.
Yeah. So
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they could pass it. Like, if anyone could pass it that's, like, human, it'd be, like, a Fremen.
Yeah, but, right. I mean, then again, Paul... I can't say Paul barely passed it, because the Reverend Mother did say that she amped it up to an extreme level, right? But
oh yeah, that's true. She just wanted to see.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, she just wanted to see by torturing Paul. Yeah, that's honestly, I just thought of it that way. Reverend Mother's pretty sadistic.
Oh my!
I don't know, but anyways, yeah.
Okay, so now Jamis is, like, trying to prepare for the ritual fight. We get a pretty in-depth description of the Fremen clothing and how they dress. So firstly, Jamis takes off his outermost cloak layer, and underneath that we see his gray steel suit, and even below that we see his loincloth. So I guess they do have underwear back in the Doom world. And on their feet, it describes it like fabric or something that's like tied around their feet. So I can only kind of describe it as like Fremen socks, right? I mean, I hope they do have actually dedicated footwear, because I don't think fabric around your foot is enough to keep like yourself comfortable while traversing through the sand all day and night. But maybe they do have something for.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure that the Fremen steel suits cover their entire body, including their feet. So you don't have to worry too much.
Sweat, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, you sweat like everywhere on your body.
Like feet especially, I heard. Like
your feet. Really? I mean, some people, I guess.
Yeah, it depends. I guess it varies from person to person. Yeah.
Well, but that gets me thinking, like, how durable are these suits? Because it said in the chapter that Jamis' suit was covered in tucks and gathers, but he's also had his suit patches.
Oh, yeah, also like patches.
So they must have ways of repairing his suit as well. Okay.
I mean, yeah, they have to, right?
So, and he's also had his suit far longer than Paul and Jessica have. So I'm going to assume that the suits are made of extremely durable material due to the harsh Fremen lifestyle. But I wonder what they have to be made of to last this long.
Yeah, I mean,
what exactly could it be?
Probably some, definitely some very flexible and stretchy material. I mean, I don't know my clothing well, but
well, I kind of imagine it to be similar to silicone.
Yeah, I would say so.
But that'd be like, it's so weird. Like,
it's really hard to imagine it.
Yeah.
Like the closest thing I could imagine would be like hardened leather, like out in the wild, because I know like the Native Americans use like hardened leather, like stretched across wooden shields. But like they don't have like mass. Well, they do have animals, but not like leather.
Not big enough animals to make those.
Yeah, it's a desert. Yeah. Animals can't survive. Yeah.
Unless they make it out of worm skin, which I don't know. I don't really see that happening.
That's interesting, actually, though. I mean, I don't know if they ever kill worms, but.
Because, yeah, they said, like, the only way to kill a worm, like, you can't even kill a worm by dropping a nuclear bomb in its mouth.
Yeah, you have to shock each individual part, and, right.
Yeah, that's almost impossible to do.
Yeah.
That's true.
That's pretty crazy. I don't know. Yeah, but so, it's really interesting to see what material they have to make these steel suits with. We, you know, with all of the times steel suits have been mentioned, we still don't really have a good idea of what goes into the making of them, so hopefully Herbert can elaborate somewhat in the future.
We also hear that like the Fremen steel suits are actually better than the factory made ones from back on like Arrakis.
Right.
So I'm actually really curious how the Fremen do it.
Yeah, they got some master steel suit makers.
Also, now we're going to talk some more about Jessica's parenting style. And I just like the vibes that I get from Jessica when she tries to step in and protect Paul here and has to be like physically pulled back by other Fremen. It's just like, I feel like Jessica's kind of helicopter parenting right now.
Oh.
Because she's like looking at Paul. She knows that her son is extremely well trained. And she even mentions that he trains with literal legends, you know, like Hawal and Gurney. And they're like, they're all legends in their own like Arrakis. They're like literally heroes, you know? And on top of that, Paul like seems confident when she saw him. Like Paul was just like, he wasn't worried. Like he sized up Jamis. Was like, I could take him on. So Jessica knows all this, and yet she doesn't have any faith in him. So I think Jessica, at this point, kind of has to put some faith in Paul, because I understand her maternal instinct is telling her to save him and to shield him from any pain, but if he's shielded too much, he'll never grow into the man he needs to be in order to carry out like the whole Atreides name and like reclaiming the throne. Which, by the way, kind of reminds me of this moment back, I don't know, like back in the beginning of the book when the Reverend Mother did tell Jessica that protecting someone too much can be harmful to the growth.
Person. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if she was alluding to this moment or moments like these. Yeah, where you know, Jessica needs just, it's also a test for Jessica, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I understand your point, but I think it sort of makes sense for her to worry this much, because not to mention this is technically Paul's real first fight, where the opponent isn't caught off guard.
Yeah.
And this is going to be nothing like the mock fights that he had with Gurney. Because as they mentioned in the chapter, they had shields in that fight, but here they don't. And to put into perspective, I'm going to do a little power scaling here, which may not be entirely accurate, but bear with me here. So based off of what we've read so far, I think we can assume that one Fremen is relative to 2 to 3 Sardaukar maybe, which are considered to be the strongest in the universe.
That's true. Yeah.
And Paul has to face one of the best Fremen warriors and kill him to prove his worth. Not to mention, he's 15 years old.
That's true. Yeah.
And keep in mind that Paul has never killed before, so it makes the task even more, or he hasn't killed like seriously before, I guess. Yeah. Like, yeah, he did kill that one guy, but not in like cold blood.
Yeah, I've killed someone with open blade. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think Jessica has every right to be as worried as she is.
Yeah, but it's interesting because from how Jamis is characterized, it doesn't seem that he's all that, his warrior abilities. So I don't even know if he's one of the strongest warriors, because Paul is even condescending towards Jamis, right? And he says that he's clumsy, and since he's bested him before, he can do it again. And, you know, as Nolan said, he's very confident. And I mean, Gurney and Idaho must have really been fantastic warriors to have trained Paul to such a level of 15 and give him this type of confidence. I feel, you know, even if that's, I'm playing tennis, I can, you know, even if, you know, I was playing tennis and it's like I have to play for my life and I'm playing someone way worse than me, I still wouldn't feel confident. But Paul somehow, you know, he's playing for his life and he feels very confident somehow.
I don't know.
Well, Stilgar did mention that he kept Jamis alive because he was useful with a blade or good in a fight.
Oh, true.
So I would assume him to be on the stronger side.
Definitely on the stronger side. Yeah,
On the stronger side, Fremen. Otherwise, he wouldn't get away with saying so much stuff about other people.
Yeah, trash talk.
Yeah, he got to back it up somehow.
Yeah. So.
Oh, but I just want to point out something really, really interesting that I read across. And I was just like, we get one of these character protagonist moments right before they go into the battle, right? Like, Paul is just here remembering all the lessons like Hawat and Gurney taught him, because they're like his mentors and like the dead people, right? The dead comrades having taught them all these lessons. And because of the power of love, friendship, and the training arc that he bared witness to, suddenly Paul was suddenly like persevere in this upcoming fight. I just thought it was like super funny because I was like, wow. Like protagonist moment, like the Super Saiyan power up moment before the fight.
With the power of friendship, I will defeat my enemy.
Oh no, yeah.
Or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think the way that Herbert wrote it raises the tension really well, because every lesson that he remembers will probably play a slight factor in his victory or loss.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I really wanted to point out is so interesting is this friendship budding between Paul and Chani. And Chani seems, and that's seems with a big question mark, seems superior to Paul, at least in desert movement and, you know, and being attuned to the desert. I'm not sure about open combat. Maybe Paul has the advantage there. But, I mean, Paul must have done something to gain Chani's trust so quickly, right? So quickly. Yeah. And considering how Paul was trying to kill, you know, her siege members and just a day ago, really. And now Paul's again having to kill another one of her siege members, and Chani's supporting him over, you know, her own siege. So that's
giving company secrets.
Yeah. So that's, I don't know how they got into each other's close circles so fast, right? So Chani's giving him a knife, giving him advice, you know, giving him encouragement. That's, yeah.
I think she must have heard about Paul through her father.
Perhaps, yeah.
Yet thought highly of Paul, so
yeah.
Maybe, or also Paul saw her through his dream, so maybe he already knows about her a little bit.
Maybe, I don't know. There's so many different.
Like, hey.
Yeah. Hey, like, hey, I saw you.
I know quite a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you could say that Chani is the girl of his dreams.
Yep. That is indeed. Yeah, if y'all don't recognize that reference, read the title of the last episode. But yeah, anyways, yeah. So that's just really interesting. I'm really happy to see that this friendship is growing. Paul definitely needs some friends. I think it was mentioned that Paul, you know, was isolated from everyone, right?
Yeah, he's a before. Lonely child.
Yeah, and so it's good to see, you know, his first.
It's good to have, you know, a friend, you know, every now and then, especially a female one. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You know, Nolan.
Nolan the down bad guy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, is down bad or bad guy, you pick.
I guess both.
Yep.
Okay, but let's go to my quote. Let's go to my quote. So we get to my quote here, which is, the good knife fighter thinks on point and blade and shearing guard simultaneously. The point can also cut, the blade can also stab, the shearing guard can also trap your opponent's blade. So this was the lesson taught to Paul by Gurney Halleck, and this is the quote about being like quick-witted and resourceful with what you have. So he's basically saying that, like, even if something isn't optimal for something or even ideal for a task, it could still do the job, you know? I really like this quote because just in the modern day, we kind of have this idea where, like, everything has its own niche. Like, we must find an optimal, like, ideal tool for everything. Kind of example is just, like, kitchen knives. We have a kitchen knife for, like, everything nowadays, for, like, filleting fish, for, like, all these different knife techniques and, like, different styles of cutting. But while it is super cool to have, like, a whole array of kitchen knives, you, like, people survive centuries without all these specialized
knives. Yeah, you don't need all of them.
Yeah, I was just like, the fact is, you're not limited just because you don't have that one special thing or tool. Like, you could actually get it done. Yeah, it may be harder, but still doable. I think that's a super important lesson that Paul will be bringing, like, throughout his entire career. Like, whether, like, past this fight or not, he'll be, this will be super important.
We're going to say this and then get canceled by all the chefs out there.
Yeah. Don't come after us. Yeah, we don't know how to cook. Yeah.
But... yeah, honestly, don't take my word, yeah.
Yes, prove us wrong. Send us an email.
Indeed. Yeah.
But send me chef's knife so that I can prove you wrong on video, you know?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, this will be a video podcast soon. Yeah.
I mean, what if Gordon Ramsay reacts to this?
Oh, no. Yeah. Where's the kitchen knives?
Where is the lamb sauce?
Yeah, anyways. Yeah, so Nolan, your quote is really interesting. I mean, the multi-purposeness and quick wit of Paul and the Fremen definitely, you know, significantly contribute to their survival. They're able to adapt to these situations so quickly, and it's kind of youth, right? But also just instinct, and, you know, that's what keeps Paul alive right now, honestly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, like, for some reason, whenever they mention a Chris knife, I always imagine it be similar, or I always imagine it to be similar to a karambit. It just, like, seems to make sense in my head, because a worm's tooth is curved, and so is a karambit.
Interesting. Right. I mean, yeah. I don't know. Wasn't it mentioned, though, that karambits aren't, well, not mentioned in the book, but aren't karambits really impractical?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they are.
Yeah. I don't remember who it was that said that, but I think karambits are somehow they just don't work well. And same with butterfly knives. I think
they're just for show.
Yeah, same with butterfly knives. You know, good luck trying to stab someone with a butterfly knife. Yeah. Yeah. I think I was discussing this with one of my friends because we were talking about knives in CSGO. And he was talking about the impracticality of all the popular butterfly knife. Karambit and stuff.
Yeah, like I would imagine it'd be difficult to stab someone with the karambit.
Yeah, because it's curved, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I guess it would be a lot easier with the butterfly knife.
Yeah, they're mainly for show. Yeah.
Yeah.
The whole, like, you have to, like, flick it out and do the swirl. That's just, like, a whole wasted second right there.
Indeed. Yeah.
But I think it's pretty satisfying to watch that, though. Okay. Like, those people animation. Who know how to do the butterfly knife tricks.
Oh, yeah. Those are. Yeah, there's, like, there's a subreddit for that. It's, like, it starts with a B. I don't remember what it's called, but they do you know, knife tricks and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, school Wi-Fi searching up knife tricks.
Indeed.
Oh my god.
Okay, so back to Paul. So actually, Paul, even though he got everything, he was confident before. He even got, like, a pep talk from Shawnee. Even got her knife, and even got, like, special insider tips. Just never mind. The whole Paul thing is confident. Just, I don't know, a farce? I can't even tell, because Paul just seems to, like, walk into the ring and suddenly gets all scared, right? Like,
yeah.
I guess he didn't realize that he had gotten himself into something much bigger than what he expected. He just chewed off more than he bit off more than
yeah.
And I guess in many ways, we're kind of like Paul as well, to be honest. Like, we go in just existing, and then until we're not, you know, and then we're just freaking out last second, to be honest.
But, yeah. Hey, you know? Yeah. You go in and feel so prepared, and then you look at question number one and there goes your confidence.
Yeah. Honestly, this has happened to me so many times.
Yeah.
I felt pretty confident about the outcome. And then at the last second, I just second guessed myself and I just messed up.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
I hope this doesn't happen to Paul, though.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in sports, if you second guess yourself, worst thing you do is lose, and that feels bad, but it's nowhere doesn't feel as bad as a knife through your heart, right? So
yeah,
here, or a loss
to the ribs.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's or, that's
I guess
more,
Chris knife to the ribs.
Yeah, that's more appropriate, I suppose, for Arrakis. I mean, here, loss comes with the price of Paul's water, and I mean, however, he has this, you know, strong armor that we keep talking about that can deflect everything, right? And I expect to see it here too, plot armor, right? And I mean, we know he won't lose, but there's oftentimes too many consequences tied to these major decisions, which is emphasized in my quote for the week. Prescience had fed his knowledge with countless experiences, hinted at the strongest currents of the future and the strings of decision that guided them. But this was the real now. This was death hanging on an infinite number of minuscule mischances. So first off, I wanted to point out how well Herbert wrote this. I mean, death hanging on an infinite number of minuscule mischances. I feel that's just so cool. Minuscule mischances. That's fun to say. But yeah, I mean, yeah, this alliteration. But no matter how much you prepare for a situation, sometimes you really can't avoid having to make decisions on the spot. And nothing can be truly scripted. And so it really comes down to your training and quick thinking. I think that's, and again, that's what's keeping them alive at this stage, right? It's just
right. You really need to be able to improvise on the spot.
Right.
Yeah. I also think that like Paul's power is just like still overloading kind of his sensory overload still like in the back of his head. So maybe just like maybe tampering or like hindering his response right now because he is getting so many different like outcomes that he's actually starting to worry because there's too many that he can't calculate in time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Yeah, just like I was saying last chapter, there it's so certain that it's uncertain, you know. Yeah. There's too many. And suddenly there's nothing. Yeah. So it's all this paradoxical contrast, you know, that's what makes this, you know, ability of prescience so well balanced, I think, so far. I think that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So this isn't really too important, but I want to end the episode by saying, or repeating the quote, fear is the mind killer.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, I this mean, is probably the most iconic quote in Dune.
Oh, well, 100%, 100%. I mean, yeah, I go on Twitter and just when I go hashtag Dune, every other tweet is just fear is the mind killer. Fear is the mind killer. I mean, it's a cool actually, quote though. I don't blame.
I got into Dune because a friend showed me this quote actually.
Oh really?
Oh really?
Yeah. Well, that's a really interesting thing. But it really is a nice quote. You know,
no matter how much people would stop overusing it.
Yeah, but I mean,
it is a little overused. It's just,
I mean. But that's, I mean, deserved, I feel, because the quote is just really powerful. Yeah. And yeah, cool. So as you said on that note, I believe that concludes the discussion for this episode of the Do Not Enter podcast. Make sure to read to the end of chapter 33 and tune in next time when we discuss it. As always, thanks to all of you listeners for being patient with us and being interested in our thoughts. Follow us on Instagram at Do Not Enter, Reddit u/Do Not Enter, Twitter at Do Not Enter, and email us at donotenter@gmail.com. That is donotenter@gmail.com. Please contact us with questions, feedback, or okay, whose turn is it? I think I said it last week, so.
Yeah, I think Nolan, it might be your turn.
Yeah.
It's my turn. So, corrections, y'all.
Honestly better than our pronunciations from the last few chapters, but but
I mean, eventually we're gonna have to say it.
Yep. Yeah, we're running out of ways to evade the, you know, the mistakes. Yeah, so
dreaded word.
Yeah, if we ever, you know, but
the
of course
C-word.
Yeah, but if of course if we made any mistakes, don't hesitate in letting us know and we'll do our best to remedy that in the upcoming episodes. Please give us a review on iTunes or Spotify. It'll only take a few seconds of your time. Just go to make an iTunes or Spotify account, of course, and then go to our podcast and click the 5-star button because, you know, that's the only button that exists. So the reason why I ask y'all to do this is twofold. The first is we would, of course, you know, love to see y'all's positive reviews, and it would encourage us to keep making content for you guys. And also, it helps get our podcast up the charts so we can get our podcast and, of course, the book Dune to a wider variety of listeners. So, you know, that would be very much appreciated, and thank you all very much. And other than that, I think that's about it. So, have a great week, and we will see y'all back very soon.
See ya, guys.
Bye, guys.